It is 8:32, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor of Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
All right, lots to cover, and I cut you off 2 minutes of it, so...
Yeah, I'll never get those 2 minutes back, you know.
Well, you might. You might. Hold that out there as the rancid carrot that it is. Let's start with local. We got a little bit of local this week.
Yeah, not much local or national because of the holiday, but a ton of international. So,
all right. Well, Norm Rice getting some headlines.
Yes, he says now he wants to become superintendent of the Seattle schools, and of course the city hall and the city council certainly want him to become superintendent of the Seattle schools. It's unclear, however, whether the school board wants him to become superintendent of the Seattle schools. Cheryl Chow, who's the assistant president of the school board, saying in interviews this week that the board is going to continue its national search and will consider Norm Rice in due diligence just with everybody else. they're going to get a little pressure on that, I predict. And one of the forms of those pressure is that Senator Ed Murray, the newly elected senator moving over from the House, acting quite perhaps on the behest of Mayor Greg Nickels, who said a couple days after that, somewhat cryptically, that he wanted to see changes in how the school district made decisions and hinted at a greater role for the city. Well, Senator Ed is going to introduce a bill in the legislature in January, he says, that would appoint rather than elect school board members. This is a really bad idea. I mean, aside from the fact that the progressive school board members that are already going to face a ferocious challenge next year would almost certainly be appointed out of a job, you know, it's again, a concentration of more power in the hands of City Hall and the city. And certainly there isn't a whole lot of evidence that you know, they have any better wisdom in how to pick a school board president than people who, I don't know, full-time pay attention to the school district. The interesting thing about Rice as a potential superintendent, well, there's several things. First of all, he would be the by my count, at least fourth superintendent in a row who comes into that district with absolutely no educational background whatsoever, after John Stanford, who was, of course, a retired general, who had headed the Fulton County, which is Atlanta, Georgia, I think county commission or something like that. And then we had Olszewski and Rajmanis, who were both from the financial side of things, but didn't actually have any experience in, you know, how to teach and what needs of students might be. So this would be number four. The positive to Norm, there's actually a couple of positives to Norm Rice's possibly being appointed to this position or hired to this position. One of them is that he would in fact be able to more effectively perhaps address one of the most glaring needs of the school district, which doesn't have to do with mismanagement. It has to do with its inability to get any kind of adequate funding out of the state legislature, something that, by the way, Ed Murray could do something about now. You know, Rice, obviously, with a fair amount of experience, not only as the mayor of the city, he also ran for governor once. He has a lot of contacts in Olympia. He would probably be far more effective down there than Manas, or for that matter, Olszewski, or even Stanford were before him. The other thing is that what Rice is doing right now, he would probably have to give up, and that would probably be a good thing, too. He is chairing the committee that's looking at ways in which the SHA can move its residents out of Yesler Terrace, so that it can be converted into, you know, high-end commercial real estate development. That is a commission that's meeting twice a month. It just had its second or third meeting, I forget which, this week, and those will be going on monthly until they come up with a recommendation for how to redevelop. I mean, move the residents. I mean, redevelop the Yesler Terrace there. So it could be interesting times coming up for the school district. But one thing is for certain is that there is going to be a concerted effort by city elite. And you can probably add our two daily papers and TV stations on top of it to get Norm Rice into the top post in Seattle Public Schools. And if by some chance the board does not hire Rice to do it, that is going to become a centerpiece of the 2007 reelection campaign. You heard it here first.
All right. Moving along to national, former U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno trying to get into the news.
Yeah, Janet Reno, who as one of her several legacies of 8 years as Attorney General, left us with Waco and something of a stain on her human rights record as a result of that, is now, along with seven other former Justice Department officials, suing the Bush administration over the Military Commissions Act, claiming that the military tribunals process that it sets up, or military commissions, is unconstitutional and an abrogation of the human rights of the detainees and suspects. Good for her. She probably isn't the best poster child for this this type of lawsuit, but it certainly is something that needs to happen. And the fact that you've got eight high-ranking former officials of the Justice Department saying that this thing is beyond the pale constitutionally should carry some weight in the courts, I would hope.
All right. Well, speaking of the courts, there is a D.C. district judge that's using some leverage this week.
Yes, Judge Richard Roberts, D.C. district judge for the federal court there, has ordered the FBI, as a result of a lawsuit, to divulge and release details of something that it's been redacting for years, which is the details of its evacuation of the Saudi royals and the bin Laden family post 9/11. This is something, and of course Michael Moore went into some detail on this in Fahrenheit 9/11. This is something that the government has been very, very close-lipped about, that not only were these folks all evacuated right after 9/11, but they were done so with virtually no questioning as to their potential role in, not just in 9/11, but in general in financing Al-Qaeda and other terror networks, which have gotten not only most of their financing from Saudi sources, but also 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi citizens. So we went after Iraq instead. But go figure. But this is something that is going to be very, very interesting. The deadline on that is December 15th. So we should know in the next 2.5 weeks or so what exactly the FBI is willing to follow a court order in order to tell the American people, and whether the U.S. media will pay any attention when it does come out.
All right. Moving along, you're proposing a new feature for this week?
Yes. Meet the new boss. Fill in the rest of your favorite Pete Townsend line at your leisure. We have now Democrats in control of Congress, the Senate and the House, and they are spending just about as much time promising what they won't do as promising what they will do. And so it seems to me that, for all the improvements that having Democrats in control of Congress might potentially represent, that we also ought to call attention to it when they don't result in improvements. And we had our first couple examples of that this week. I mean, aside from the fact of all the things they've already said they won't do, and we'll talk about what they're not doing when they're actually in session. But they are now lining up behind the nomination of Robert Gates, who Robert Perry talked very eloquently about during Counterspin, as the new Department of Defense Secretary. Gates has all kinds of blood on his hand from his time as a CIA director, his role in Iran-Contra, his role in arming the Iranians, his role in arming Saddam Hussein, including with chemical and biological weapons during the Iraq-Iran war, and so on and so on and so forth, the October surprise in 1980, just a nasty, nasty record that if Democrats wanted to, they could delay the nomination until January and investigate this guy, particularly since during his confirmation hearings as CIA director in 1991, it is now known categorically that he lied about some of this stuff. Evidence has come out since then that showed that he was simply not telling the truth. This should be a problem, but apparently instead you've got a number of Democrats now coming out saying they will support his nomination, and he is expected to be confirmed before Congress adjourns, probably on December 8th, the end of next week. Yeah, 2 weeks from yesterday. So, yeah. That being said, the fact that Congress is adjourning a week early, and this has to be the Congress that has met the least of any Congress in modern U.S. history, one of the things that the Republican lame ducks are doing, aside from the fact that they're not getting to many of the things that George Bush hoped they would ram through before they left, is that they're leaving the Democrats in January with a $500 billion of spending bills and budgets still to cobble together for fiscal year 2007. This means, in turn, that all of the promises that Democrats have made for all the glorious things they're going to do when they take over in January probably aren't going to happen. The reason they're not going to happen, though, isn't necessarily the Democrats' fault. It's that statutorily they have to get these spending bills passed, and that's going to require a lot of work. Now, the budget should be a little bit better because the Democrats are chairing all the committees and cobbling together the budget deals, but it does mean that all the damage they're trying to undo from the past 6 years is going to have to wait a little bit of a while, at least a little bit of a while. Look for the feature in following weeks.
All right. Moving along, Michael Chertoff.
Yes, the Department of Homeland Security head, who for some reason after Katrina still has his job, had a very interesting speech a week ago yesterday to the Federalist Society, which is, folks may know, is a group of activist lawyers who would like to go back to the way the Constitution was originally written. You know, black people have 3/5 of a vote, and or not 3/5 of a vote, but 3/5 of a person. They don't have any vote at all. You know, that kind of you know, dispensing of the subsequent amendments to the Constitution. In other words, a very, very conservative group of activist lawyers and judges. In any event, he had a speech to the Federalist Society in which he shared his chilling vision, that's a direct quote, of a future in which the United States' actions would be constrained by, drumroll please, international law. In other words, specifically, he doesn't want international law to be able to prevent the U.S. from not only committing torture, but also committing war crimes. He thinks the U.S. should be able to commit war crimes without anybody else caring whatsoever. This is kind of an alarming statement coming from one of the top government officials in the country, and particularly the guy who's the ultimate head of FEMA and the ultimate guy who's in charge of all those detention camps that they keep building around the country. So you do wonder what's going on here, and again, why this didn't get more headlines.
Those detention camps built by Halliburton.
Yes.
All right.
Which we can take some solace in the fact that they were probably constructed pretty poorly, and you might be able to get out of them pretty easily.
One can only hope. All right. Well, one would have almost expected that to be in your Sleaze of the Week groupings, but no.
No. We have something else on Sleaze of the Week instead. That being a report by the Electronic Vote Alliance, which monitors the fairness of elections in the United States, which, you know, international observers should be doing on a regular basis these days. And it claims, on the basis of statistical analysis of exit polls compared with the actual final vote counts, that some 3 million votes were almost certainly hacked in the electronic voting machines or otherwise, you know, somehow not counted, as in Florida 13, over the course of November 7th. Again, something that at minimum deserves more investigation. The way they were describing it is the way you would have to pre-program some of these machines to tally inaccurately would have had to have been done in early October before they were dispersed to the different county and precinct levels, and that on the basis of how the vote was expected to turn out then, and the tide swung just dramatically against the Republicans over the following 4 or 5 weeks, and so they miscalculated the margin of victory that would be needed, and as a result still lost quite badly in a number of districts, but not nearly as badly as they would have had. Overall, a national average of about 4% more badly had the statistical anomalies not been found. So, you know, again, makes you wonder whether it wasn't a matter of our dodging a bullet in terms of electoral fairness, but simply we overwhelmed the way in which the game was rigged this time, and it's still very much a problem that is with us, and we'll have more on electronic voting machines in our international section, yeah, interestingly enough.
Well, don't worry. They're going to work on that national problem and have that fixed next time around. So
I'm sure they will.
All right. Well, let's move on to international.
Who's they, and how do you define fixed?
Well, that's a show in itself.
Yes, it is.
All right. Moving on to international, Iraq.
Ugh. You know, every week you keep thinking it can't get much worse, and it keeps getting much worse. This week, Britain, Tony Blair at the beginning of the week, acknowledging that the Iraq war is, quote, a disaster. At least we have a somewhat honest head of state over in the UK, anyway, or at least realistic. And later in the week, the British government announcing that they will pull out of Basra, their troops in the south of the country, by spring 07. That is to say, before Blair leaves office, which is scheduled at this point for May. The British are getting out, while the getting is at least, I wouldn't say good, but better than it's going to be later on. Meanwhile, the trip through and beyond hell in a handbasket continues in Iraq itself this week. On Thursday, over 200 people killed by Sunni bombs in the Shiite stronghold of Sadr City, the base of Muqtada al-Sadr and his Mahdi army. Yesterday, retaliatory attacks for that, including six Sunnis who were attacked in public in Baghdad, had kerosene poured on them and were set aflame while Iraqi soldiers watched. Interestingly enough, there was a report that was leaked, an internal army report this week, according to the Washington Post, that said the Iraqi army, the training program by the U.S. of the Iraqi army is, quote, rife with problems. I would say that standing around and watching while attacks on civilians are carried out would constitute a problem, but there were many, many others, as we've keep talking about week after week. Another interesting sidelight to the violence in Iraq this week, which is just getting worse and worse, is that several media outlets, I've got quotes from the New York Times and AP here, and ABC did it, and other places as well, keep referring to the violence in the last couple days as, the New York Times had it as it could spiral into full-scale civil war. It's according to the AP, rapidly heading into full-scale civil war. Makes you wonder what their criteria for full-scale civil war are. For example, the number of deaths reported from not just battlefield deaths but also disease and whatnot during the U.S. Civil War, which went on for 2 years longer than, that is, the U.S. Civil War that went on for 2 years longer than the war in Iraq has gone on so far, is less than what we've already seen so far in Iraq. And, of course, many of those deaths in Iraq have just come in the last year. So you would think that the rate of dying in Iraq right now would qualify by any objective analysis, since Iraq has a much smaller population than the U.S. had in the 1860s. But no, not so far. I guess we're not quite there yet, according to the New York Times, the AP, and ABC, and others. Meanwhile, the ominous status of the Iraqi government itself, the parliamentary allies of Muqtada al-Sadr, as I mentioned, were the that movement was the target of the attack in Sadr City on Thursday, and they're carrying out many of the retaliatory attacks yesterday and today. Those MPs saying on I think it was Wednesday or Thursday that they would boycott the parliament if Prime Minister al-Maliki goes to Amman this coming week to meet George Bush. Now, that puts Maliki in a very difficult situation, since he needs the support of both Bush and of the Mahdi army affiliates in parliament. He's very much clinging to power right now. It raises the question that one or the other, either the United States or the Iraqi parliamentarians, are probably going to push Maliki, I think, out of power even before the end of the year. He has a very, very shaky hold on power right now, very little public support because almost all sides blame the Iraqi government in large part, along with U.S. soldiers, for having done so little to prevent the spiraling violence there. Another indication that the Iraqi government is moving away from any kind of respect for the United States is that it announced this week that after a 25-year hiatus, they are going to resume diplomatic relations with Syria. And finally, the UN reporting this week that 3,709, funny how they can come up with such an exact number, it's probably wrong, probably low, 3,709 civilians died in October. However, if you compare that with previous months, it is in fact a new high, which matches the estimates that other people have had as well.
All right. Moving along, Bahrain.
Yeah, this was a nasty, nasty week for the Middle East. Bahrain is having parliamentary elections today. The situation in Bahrain, a Gulf Coast oil state where the U.S. is, it only has 700,000 people in it, but it also has the home of the United States Navy's Fifth Fleet. So the United States has an awful lot to do with the domestic politics there. They've only had one election in the last 30 years. They're having a second one today, and this election has been marred by great controversy because a dissident government official came out with a report that that the minority Sunnis are trying to use all sorts of tricks in order to hang on to power against the majority Shiite population, even with the elections. This includes trying to bring in immigrants to change the demographics of the country, paying very poor Sunnis in order to convert to becoming Shiites, and most interestingly enough, rigging the electronic voting machine for today's election. And that includes, you know, the release of detailed documents and financial and bank account records by government officials that are showing where the payments are going and exactly how they plan to do this with electronic voting machines. Much more specific information than we have seen in U.S. elections, for example, about how this can be done and the fact that a government is in fact doing it. So worth keeping an eye out over there for anybody who's interested in the sanctity of voting machines.
And Lebanon and Israel.
Messy, messy also there. Lebanese industry minister Pierre Gemayel, who is sort of the Gemayel family, sort of the equivalent of the Kennedys or the Bushes in the United States, a very influential family. He was assassinated in Beirut on Tuesday. That is leading to a UN Security Council decision to investigate it, along with the assassination of former Prime Minister Hariri a couple of years ago. A lot of suspicion that Syria was involved in this. Syria is saying no, that in fact it was the forces, the pro-American forces, that are trying to cast aspersion on Syria by in fact assassinating him themselves and so forth. So ugly over there. Meanwhile, the Israeli government is saying that U.S.-made unexploding cluster bombs that were used in Lebanon, and have led to a number of civilian deaths since the end of that war this summer, were used for budgetary reasons. The reason is because the cluster bombs that are made by Israel are newer and more effective, but they would have had to come out of their own budget, whereas the U.S. just gives them away. Prime Minister Olmert was in D.C. over last weekend, and on Monday he said that the U.S. war in Israel has brought, in Iraq, has brought stability to the Middle East, which is kind of a jaw-dropping statement. And Bush responded to one of his own jaw-dropping statements that he would understand if Israel chose to attack Iran. It's so good to know there's sane leadership in Tel Aviv and in Washington. Hamas made an announcement that it is willing to call for a six-month ceasefire in order for Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority to launch peace talks with Israel. No response from Israel as of yet. The UN has vetoed a Security Council resolution that condemns the civilian deaths in Gaza, which are being caused and continue to be caused by Israeli bombing and siege there. The top UN human rights official, however, calls Gazans as suffering suffering, quote, massive human rights violations. And finally, a study released in Israel this week showing that 40% of all Israeli settlements, and that word is in quotes, are built on stolen private land belonging, or at least once belonging, to Palestinians.
All right, and Seymour Hersh writing this week.
Yes, another very good article by Hersh in The New Yorker. I won't even try to summarize it, but the most interesting thing there is that there's a secret CIA report that he uncovered that says the U.S. has found no evidence so far of a secret Iranian nuclear weapons program, but that the White House was, quote, hostile to those findings.
All right. And George Bush doing some traveling.
Yes, he was in Hanoi this week for APEC and did very poorly there, actually. Not only did he not nearly get the reception in Hanoi that Bill Clinton did 6 years ago, but he also was trying on several occasions to talk South Korea and the other members of the six-party agreement, the Asian countries, Russia and China and Japan as well, to take harsher measures against North Korea, and then failed. And then he was supposed to have an overnight in Indonesia after that, wound up only staying there 6 hours and not staying overnight, because the Secret Service was concerned that militants might attack Bush while he was there. All popular right. guy.
Talk a bit about arms sales.
Yeah, a couple of different interesting reports that came out this week. One from Aviation Week that the Pentagon had budgeted for $13 billion in arms sales this year to different parts of the world. Instead, it's going to be about $21 billion. Business is booming, so to speak. Also, there was a report by the Congressional Research Service, their annual report, showing that the U.S. now has almost half of all weapons that are sold to countries in the third world. Second on that list is Russia at 15%, and then Britain at 13%. So we are selling an overwhelming percentage of the death around the world.
And very quickly, India and Pakistan.
Yeah, they had peace talks last week. This week, they launched two nuclear-capable missiles at each other. Test missiles, I should say.
So, not directly at each other.
Not directly at each other, no. But they were certainly diplomatically intended at each other. So much for the peace talks, and so much for George Bush's stellar non-proliferation strategies, which have included nuclear deals with India and dropping sanctions for the nuclear program in Pakistan.
All right, and quickly, events.
Yeah, well, the big one this week, there's one tonight, of course, also. If you heard 7:30, the Darfur Diaries, that's going to be premiering at Langston Hughes at 7 o'clock. And then also on Thursday night, the FCC is in town having a hearing on loosening ownership rules and cross-ownership between television stations, radio stations, and newspapers. That will be from 6 to 9 o'clock at the main auditorium of the Seattle Central Library downtown, just blocks from where WTO happened, or the protest against WTO started 7 years ago on the very same date. So if you believe in protesting corporate control of democracy, N30 is again a fine time to turn out this year.
Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State, and quickly tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. We are in the middle of a fund drive, so if you would like to contribute to help us perpetuate this sort of information in and around Seattle and the world, we would very much appreciate it. You can do that through the mail, or you can do it on the web, where you can find all of our issues as well at www.eatthestate.org, or you can find the paper free of charge at bookstores, cafes, King County Library System. And if you have any questions on that, or anything you've heard on this program for that matter, or comments or feedback, so you want more information on how to donate or volunteer, any of that, give our voicemail a call. The number is area code 206-719-6947.